Solutions UK. Are you looking for best practices and innovative strategies to foster confident, lifelong readers? Join the free online international reading conference on the 11th, 12th and 13th of June. Hear from speakers like TV personality and education expert Basit Siddiqui, beloved children's author Michael Rosen, fluency expert Tim Rosinski, EEF specialist Chloe Butlin, the National Literacy Trust's Irene Picton, and a range of experienced practitioners, including MAT leaders, deputy heads, heads of English, high-level teaching assistants, and school librarians. Through the three-day conference, speakers will explore a range of topics at the forefront of the current educational landscape, with sessions relevant for all educators and key stages. Visit Reading Solutions at readingsolutionsuk.co.uk for more information and to sign up for this free conference.
Thank you for joining me again. It's Sabrina on air today, here again, but with a different topic. We're working with Becky. We're going to go looking at mental health for educators and how we are supporting, working with and developing on all of these really key hot topics to make our days a little bit easier, really. So Becky, if you just introduce yourself and tell us how you've got here and what you've been doing to become so knowledgeable around this idea and topic.
Good morning, Sabrina. Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it. So I've been in education for over 20 years. I was a teacher in mainstream education. I was a drama teacher. And then towards the end of my career, a special educational needs coordinator and a safeguarding lead. And I loved teaching. It was just, you know, it was the career I wanted. It was everything for me. But I did, unfortunately, and I know we'll talk about this a little bit later, kind of hit burnout towards the end of my teaching in mainstream and ended up leaving and working for the local authority, still working with schools, but looking at a whole school approach to mental health and well-being. And quite often when we talk about a whole school approach, we forget to talk about staff and the importance of looking after staff, mental health and well-being. And the work that I do now is focusing on supporting staff to, yes, understand mental health and well-being for children and young people, but also part of all of the work I do is how people look after themselves. And that, you know, the phrase I always use is, you can't pour from an empty cup. You can't help other people if you don't have the kind of have the sleep, the eating, the, you know, the ways of looking after yourself. It's just not possible. And I think, you know, one of the struggles with the teaching profession is that we work so hard and still expect to be able to work at the same level, and I just don't think it's possible.
So, I mean, if we unpick a little bit of that, so I know you mentioned, you know, staff mental health and well-being. What is the picture out there right now? What's going on in relation to staff well-being and mental health?
Well, you know, I'm on a few different Facebook groups, and, you know, a lot of what I see is that staff feel under a huge amount of pressure. We've just had today, haven't we, last week, the decision, pause and you can edit it out. Last week, they made the decision about the single kind of word decisions on Ofsted, and that had a huge impact on staff well-being. And, you know, we know that teachers work long hours. They have to deal with a lot. You know, again, last week we had that awful incident with teachers getting stabbed in a school in Wales. There is a huge amount going on for teachers at the moment. And that's on top of the pressure of getting exam results, of teaching big classes, of, you know, fulfilling several roles, because we know that there's a kind of a crisis in recruitment. So many teachers are having to have lots of different responsibilities. You know, there is a huge amount going on for teachers that is just a lot to deal with, and I think that, you know, from what I see, from the people I speak to, from colleagues who are still in mainstream teaching, it's a lot. They're happy in the classroom. Generally, when they're in the classroom, that's their happy safe space.
Yeah.
the other paperwork, the other expectations that can be a challenge.
Right, and so, I mean, there's so much there to kind of pick up on. But if we talk about those pressures, how real are these pressures and how are they manifesting in the staff? And what kind of signs and symptoms are we seeing in the workforce that demonstrates, you know what, this person is not is not well, they've got too much on, or they're too stressed?
Yeah. Well, I think there are a lot of teachers who are taking time off now, work-related sickness, because of the pressure, because it's not the sort of job that you can go in and kind of do half-heartedly if you're not feeling to it. You're standing up in front of 30 young people, you know, every hour for 5 hours. It's not the sort of job you can really put on a brave face for, I don't think. I think lots of people try, but there is a point at which it becomes really difficult to do that. And so I think there is a kind of the numbers of teachers leaving the profession altogether, the numbers of teachers having to take time off is huge. And just, you know, the and a lot of this I'm talking about now is anecdotal, but, you know, hearing about the effect it has on marriages, and I know it had an impact on my marriage, because if you're married to a teacher, you know, you barely see them quite often. For a lot of people, you're, you know, I know I was working till 11 at night, and I was working every weekend. I was working in those, all those amazing holidays we get, you know, I was working through most of them. So it has an impact not just on the person, but on their relationships, on their families. And it's just impossible to be at your best when you're working under that pressure, I think.
I used to teach on the teacher training, and I remember I used to have new staff used to say, oh, I want to be a teacher, I want the holidays. And I used to say, that's such a false economy, that you don't understand that although you're not coming on site, or maybe you are, but you don't have to come on site, you essentially are still working, because you take home your books, you're marking, you're responding to emails, you're sorting out cover, and all of that is happening, except you're supposedly on holiday.
and
I used to tell the staff, God.
I was going to say, you know, I'm sure my teachers would agree, when you get to the end of that half term, you literally have nothing else to give. You need that holiday, don't you? It's not a case of it's a nice to have. It's a, like, if I don't have this,
how
I'm
die.
Not going to be able to go much further. Yeah.
Yeah. And there are, in some cases as well, when you get to that holiday, it certainly was for me when I was teaching, I saved up all the bugs and all the, you know, when you're feeling run down, you kind of wait until it's holiday time and think, right now I can be ill.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it's always October half term, Christmas, you always needed at least a week out to finally just have that cold or that flu or that chest infection that was waiting for you. So yeah, definitely. We're seeing that as well in the FE sector, that the massive increase in work-related stress, work-related absences. We're seeing people kind of being a bit more open about disclosing that, you know, that they're feeling pressured, they're feeling stressed, they're feeling anxious, and so staff are saying, you know, I'm not coming in, or I'm not doing that. I don't know if we're at a point now where organizations are effectively responding to that or knowing what to do. So what would you recommend if you were a manager, or if you're an organization where you're seeing this happen in your workforce? What kind of strategies, or what can we put in place to support an increasing number of staff feeling like this?
Well, you know, I think it's very difficult for schools, colleges, because a lot of these pressures are external. They come from central government, and it's not as if a school can just turn around and say, oh, well, we're not worried about what GCSE A-level results we get. That's just not going to happen. So I think that's one kind of challenge we have to see, is that actually some of this is systemic. It's the way the education system is created. It's all about those final exam results. Ofsted are all about, you know, those four grades, and you don't get any kind of leeway on that basis. But what I would say about organizations is, where I see it going wrong is when they do kind of very kind of plasters over the scratch type thing. So, oh, well, you can have yoga on a training day, or we'll put biscuits in a staff room. And I just think that is so far from what people really want. People want an expectation that they don't have to email and reply to emails at midnight or at the weekend. They want an expectation that they're not going to be asked to write lots of reports, but at the same time that they've got parents evening. They want things in the system that look after their well-being, rather than, and you know, biscuits in the staff room are nice, but they should be an add-on, not the well-being program as a whole. And I think the only way you can really do that is to speak to staff. It, you know, we talk a lot about co-production, well, I certainly do, co-production with young people and working with young people, but we need to do that with staff as well. We need to really understand, as much as senior leadership teams will have been teachers, it's very quick to forget. You're very quick to forget what it's like to be in front of the classroom 5 hours a day, you know, and teaching that load. So taking the time to actually work with staff to understand, because the pressure points will be different in different schools. It's not a case of being able to go, this is the program we should all be working by. It's got to be different things for different schools, dependent on what the need is. So different schools need to look at it. And the only way they can do that is by speaking to stakeholders. What do staff need? What do students need to be successful? How do we make those two things happen? Because happy, well staff will absolutely feed into successful students, because it's a no-brainer.
And when we're talking about the successful students, I think another barrier of seeing impacting staff mental health has been recent challenges with behaviours in classrooms. So behaviour is commonly known as the biggest reason why people leave teaching, because the undesirable behaviours from the students leads to such a mental load and a strain on the teaching staff. And recently it's been shown again in all of the kind of statistics and publications that poor behaviour is on the increase. How can we support staff who are day in, day out dealing with really challenging behaviours in schools and left quite powerless or limited in the scope of dealing with it properly? What can organisations, people, individuals, anyone do?
Yeah, I think that's, again, it's a tough one, isn't it? Because there is no easy fix. I think COVID has absolutely had an impact on young people and their ability to cope. I think, you know, when we're talking about behaviour that challenges us, I would always go from the point of view of having the time and the capacity to explore why that behaviour is happening. Now, I don't think classroom teachers have that time necessarily. And that's why I'm always, you know, always so saddened when it's always the pastoral non-teaching staff are the first ones to go if they have to make redundancies, or it's seen that we don't have money for those kind of roles. But actually they can make a huge difference. Funding for SEN, kind of really putting a focus on additional needs and looking at what is underlying this behavior, how do we understand this behavior, and ensuring that teachers have training in trauma-informed work. And again, it's not for me to, I'm not saying that teachers need to be able to be a mental health first aider at that point of the door when they walk through. It's really tough to do all of those things, but there needs to be the support system and the network to be able to look at why the young person or child is behaving as they are, the external resources which we don't have to kind of support that and think about what we can do for that young person, but also really robust support and pastoral support to ensure that there is somewhere for that young person to go if they're not able to go in that classroom at that point, and that the teacher isn't having to have a big standoff with them when their behaviour isn't as it should be. There are so many different things that we can be looking at, but it comes down to funding and it comes down to what are the priorities. And when the priorities for the schools are results, then maybe other things go to the wayside. I know lots of brilliant schools where they prize results, but they know that the way of getting there is by having good pastoral care, having good training for staff, having good additional support for young people that need it. And, you know, ensuring that young people get the support that they need and teachers get the support they need as well. You know, hopefully I'll get the opportunity to bang on about supervision or some sort of support for teachers where they can actually talk about what they're experiencing in the classroom, rather than just line management meetings where they're ticking off jobs that they've done or haven't done.
We're talking about kind of the funding and all of the elements that can support the behaviours such as the pastoral care. I know of several organisations that are investing into that. However, these posts are just not filling, so we are unable to recruit. What is happening in terms of people wanting to come in and support the mental health and whole school well-being? Is there something you know that you could share about that sector and as to why is it so unappealing to want to do such a rewarding job? Why do people want to, is qualifications? I don't know.
It might be qualifications. I find that often non-teaching roles are very poorly paid. So it depends on the rate of pay. If you think, you know, I personally think teaching assistants are some of the most important adults that we have in the school in being able to support in this work, both in colleges and in schools. And I think they, and they're so poorly paid that, you know, it's no wonder that people aren't kind of rushing to fill those jobs when it's like, what, £15,000-16,000 a year pro rata, you know, but yet they are often facing some of the most challenging behaviours, dealing with those things. If we really put our support and money into those kind of staff, we would probably get people to deal with those things or be able to give them the training that they need to be able to do those things. So I think that's a big part of it. I think the press doesn't really give us a very good idea of what school, if you just read the press, you would think that all schools were full of rioting teenagers constantly and it was just a war zone, which we know, you know, it's tough. But it certainly isn't that. So I think, you know, lots of people will look at that and think, no, not likely. But yeah, then maybe it's about the progression as well of how what progression is there for people going into those roles.
What is the progression? Is there progression? Are you aware of?
It's not something that, you know, I'm not aware of. I think it would be brilliant to think about how you could have learning mentors that then could be and go into leadership in those spaces and take on other qualifications and think about what that might look like, but it's certainly not seen as a profession as such, I don't think, in many ways.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. So you were talking about the press there and obviously some of my favourite things to do is to scroll there, the socials and see what's happening. How is it perceived in terms of staff mental health out there and mental health for educators as a whole? Is there a recognition? Is there, I mean, I know obviously the story with the inspection and the headmistress, it really did turn an eye towards it. But prior to that, was there much? And following on from that, is there anything substantive that you're seeing?
Well, I think COVID did do teachers a favour in some respects because parents were at home trying to oversee education and realising that it's not as easy as they might have thought. So I think in some ways that gave people an insight into what teachers are trying to do every day. But I definitely think there's still this kind of idea that teachers work from 8 till 3 and have all these holidays. And I do think that there is a lack of understanding of what is actually going on in the classroom. So I do think that, you know, kind of it would be good to have some press that actually explored what the realities are of teaching.
And for a person who's obviously dealing with those issues and supporting teachers, what do you think is what's working for specific individuals and what do you think is might be beneficial for more people to try?
So I think it's one of the hardest things, but I think it's about having boundaries. And we talked a little bit about that beginning when some teachers are kind of pushing back and going, no, actually that's not in my job description, or that's not, you know, people being asked to do work outside of the kind of the allotted hours. You know, there's, you know, people kind of just assume that teachers will work till 5 and work in the holidays. No one's ever kind of thought about the, you know, the time that we should be working and the hours that we should be doing. So having boundaries, being clear. I know that when I was teaching, my biggest struggle was that I had emails on my phone and I was constantly checking them. You know, so I would get emails from angry parents at 11 o'clock midnight and it would just be in my head then, and it would really affect my mental health, and I would be thinking about it all weekend and I'd be working all weekend. So helping staff to know it's okay to have boundaries, it's okay to work certain hours and not feel that you have to be doing it 24/7, but that will only come when the workload allows it, because there is a lot of stress when you're not getting through the things you need to get through. And that's when you will work those extra hours to get it done, because no one wants to walk into a classroom unprepared. No one wants to do that. No one wants to not mark the work for their students. But it's balancing that with the paperwork, the reports, the things they have to do, or are told they have to do, that take up the hours and hours, the paperwork, etc. The changing in the different approaches that schools do quite regularly often. How do we do that and ensure that teachers can have boundaries in place to look after their well-being and know that it's okay to have that? I felt guilty for a long time about worrying about, you know, about taking time off, about not working lots of hours. It always becomes not a competition, but if, you know, if you're not working till midnight, you feel like you've not done enough, and that's ridiculous.
Do you think that staff, when they start doing that, when they set up those boundaries, do you think they're likely to be understood why they're putting up those boundaries?
That's why it's got to come from the top. That's why it's got to be through leadership. That's why it's got to be an ethos in the school. You know, it can't come just, absolutely staff can do it themselves, but it really has to be an ethos from the school. It really has to be clear that the SLT do not expect you to do X, Y, and Z. In order for it to work, because otherwise you potentially, you know, I'm on a particular Facebook group where, you know, people are talking about leaving the profession because they are being told they have to do things at 4 o'clock on one afternoon, 4, 8 o'clock the next morning, and, you know, things that they're just, you just wouldn't expect anyone to be able to get done. But there's a high expectation that SLT are kind of putting on people, and that's only because SLT then have that high expectation on them from Ofsted. I'm certainly not SL, you know, bashing senior leadership team here. I was on the senior leadership team. I know the pressures that you are under, and, you know, we've talked about the impact it can have to not get a good Ofsted result. And so that's where what's led to it, but it has to be an ethos of the school rather than an individual, I think.
Well, if you are a lecturer or a teacher within a school or an organisation that hasn't got that ethos, is there something that, you know, that could happen? Because that's a lovely concept and a lovely idea, but I'm not sure a lot of organisations are there yet. And ultimately, even if they say, we don't expect you to do this, you'll find they're still, they're the ones sending an email at 9 p.m. So then you think, oh, if my boss is sending me an email at 9 p.m, I better read it. So sometimes it feels like they're saying, you know, they're giving the lip service. Yeah. You know, we don't want you working out of hours, and we're very conscious of that. However, you find that actions are quite different. So if you were a person kind of seeing that and facing that, and you knew that it was bringing you down and impacting your well-being, what advice would you give to them, or what could you suggest that they do to help manage and support that, if there is any?
Well, I mean, there hopefully would be the opportunity for them to speak to senior leadership teams, speak to their line manager, explain the impact that it's having on them. Worst case scenario, they could speak to their union, because a lot of the things that people are being asked to do potentially are outside of their contracts and the expectations from teacher standards, you know. So if they wanted to go down that route, then they would be absolutely within their rights to do that. Speaking to governors is another thing that potentially could be done, but it's just sad that we're in this situation where people feel unable to speak to their leaders about things that might be impacting their mental health and well-being, because ultimately it's the young people in the school that will lose out if that person is not able to do their job properly. You're on mute.
Yeah. Do you find instances where you are working with certain organisations or people and they just don't understand, and you feel like, what can I do to let you see what's going on here? And how have you had then to respond to them?
Yeah, I've definitely had situations like that. And it is really difficult because, as I've said, the senior leadership team are working with their own pressures. It's not like they're sitting with their feet up, not doing anything. They are working hard as well, and it is very difficult. But I think in that case, that's why I think, like, work that I do around whole school approach to mental health and well-being has to be an ongoing relationship. It can't just be a go in, do some training and leave. It has to be an opportunity to be a critical friend and to go in and show the impact of making the changes, have those conversations regularly, get feedback from stakeholders and feed that back to the senior leadership team, have those conversations in order to kind of just be tenacious and wear people down until they see the impact. But also, I think there's something around sharing good practice. You know, we perhaps don't do enough of that, like linking schools up and saying, look, this is what's happening over here, this is the impact. Because sometimes heads, senior leaders are scared of letting off their foot off the gas in case everything falls apart and they get a terrible Ofsted. Well, you know, if they can see another school that has, or a college that is doing things differently but successfully, then that can make an impact. And that's when I was working in Newham, it was brilliant because I was working with lots of different schools and colleges, so I could say, oh well, I've seen this good practice here, let me put you together with this other leader and you can have a conversation, and this is good practice, and sharing those things. And I think, again, we're so focused on the end result of those GCSEs, we sometimes don't have the time to sit back and do that work.
Is there any time or any particular period that you tend to see a spike in oral mental health? Because do you find that more teachers seek support, say, at the start of the year, towards the end of the year, or anything like that? I know, obviously, you've mentioned Ofsted a few times, and I'm assuming when the call is looming or immediately after a poor inspection, you might feel particularly affected. So I just wondered in terms of...
I think definitely, obviously, January is the hardest, you know, coming back after Christmas and dark months, you know, short days, etc. But we talk about Ofsted coming, but I've had experience being in schools where the fear of Ofsted is constant, where that is what people are talking about all the time. They're focusing on what if Ofsted turn up, and there's only like a little honeymoon period just after an inspection where you know they can't turn up, so they've only been there a couple of weeks before, and then you get back on the hamster wheel. So I think potentially a lot of schools are feeling this a lot of the time.
Wow. So like the Ofsted thing can really just kick back up again a few months after.
Yeah.
Oh. And what, in terms of that hamster wheel, is it just, you know, as you mentioned before, the paperwork, the admin, the working long hours to ensure Ofsted readiness? So would you say Ofsted was a bigger threat to mental health and wellbeing than, say, the target grades, progress 8, and all of the other kind of stuff we have in secondary schools and FE and things like that?
I think, absolutely. I think Ofsted is one of the biggest threats to staff mental health and wellbeing, because it is such a kind of a cut and dry. If you don't get the good or outstanding, then, you know, that could mean dropping numbers of young people. That means that you are, you know, struggling for funding as well. There's so many things that come with that that Ofsted decision, and it can really impact, you know, senior leadership's careers. It can impact on how people are employed, whether you or your staff leave and go to other schools, and then you've got this kind of a vicious cycle where the school starts to dip in performance because of the kind of the reaction to it. When there are many schools that don't work to Ofsted, and I kind of use that phrase because there are some schools where everything they do is to be Ofsted ready, and once you start into that mindset, you've lost focus. You're there to educate young people, aren't you, and children, and to create the kind of next generation, not to keep Ofsted happy. And that's where we then lose kind of focus on what we can do to have an impact for young people.
Reading Solutions UK. Are you looking for best practices and innovative strategies to foster confident, lifelong readers? Join the free online international reading conference on the 11th, 12th and 13th of June. Hear from speakers like TV personality and education expert Basit Siddiqui, beloved children's author Michael Rosen, fluency expert Tim Rosinski, EEF specialist Chloe Butlin, the National Literacy Trust's Irene Picton, and a range of experienced practitioners, including MAT leaders, deputy heads, heads of English, high-level teaching assistants and school librarians. Through the three-day conference, speakers will explore a range of topics at the forefront of the current educational landscape, with sessions relevant for all educators and key stages. Visit Reading Solutions at readingsolutionsuk.co.uk for more information and to sign up for this free conference.
This is Teachers Talk Radio, and this is Teachers Talk Radio News.
The BBC reports on proposed changes to sex and relationship education guidance for schools in England. According to the report on the news website, government sources have told the BBC about the plans, which include banning sex education for under nines, as well as additional guidance for teaching about gender identity. Prime Minister Rishi Sunak said the new guidance would ensure children were not exposed to disturbing content. Teachers have responded with concerns that some of the guidance appears contradictory and say there is no evidence of a widespread problem with current guidance. The new plans say secondary school pupils will learn about protected characteristics such as sexual orientation and gender reassignment, but makes it clear that schools should not teach about the concept of gender identity. It said it was right to take a cautious approach. Education Secretary Gillian Keegan, speaking on BBC Breakfast, said biological sex is the basis of relationship, sex and health education, not these contested views. ASCL's General Secretary said that it was important that banning the teaching of gender identity did not shut down discussion, and that young people must be able to discuss this without their teachers feeling in peril of saying something wrong. The new guidance also strengthens rules to make it easier for parents to access teaching materials to see what their children are learning, although many point out that this guidance is currently in place. Lucy Emerson of the Sex Education Forum said, "If topics were to be restricted, it will leave children even more dependent on getting answers from online sources." The draft guidance is now open to a 9-week consultation, but once finalised, will be statutory. An outline of the proposed new age restrictions can be found on the BBC News website and the consultation on the Department for Education website. In the United States, pro-Palestinian protests at colleges and universities have made the news again, as some graduates from Duke University in North Carolina staged a walkout. The protest came just prior to a speech by veteran comedian Jerry Seinfeld, who was due to receive an honorary degree. Mr. Seinfeld has been a vocal supporter of Israel since the 7th of October attacks by Hamas. Some students stayed to hear the speech, but videos posted on social media also showed some booing and chanting slogans in support of Palestine. Whilst the ceremony at Duke went ahead, plans at other universities, including Columbia and the University of Southern California, have cancelled or restructured their main graduation ceremonies to avoid further complications. The Daily Mirror features comments from Strictly Judge Shirley Ballas about free school meals. She focuses on her own experiences of being raised by a single mother and says she understands what increasing numbers of British children living in poverty are going through. She recalls looking forward to her free school meal, referring to it as a nice lunch every day. At 63, Ms. Ballas is hoping to use her experiences to highlight the issue of poverty by being part of an ITV documentary called Kids in Poverty. According to the Mirror, 4.3 million children in Britain get their only meal a day at school. 30% of UK children are living below the poverty line, with a million classed as being in extreme poverty. Figures from the Joseph Rowntree Foundation say that the share of children living in absolute poverty has increased by 148% since 2017 and is at its highest level for 30 years. The documentary can be seen on demand, and full details of the article from The Mirror are on its website. Finally, students at Lancaster University have voted for all food served on campus to be plant-based, according to BBC Radio Lancashire. The Students' Union is supporting the gradual transition to 100% vegan menus with a target of 50% by 2025 and 100% by 2027. A campaigner told the BBC that Lancaster University has a goal of net zero by 2035 and that implementing a plant-based catering system aligns with this goal. The Countryside Alliance said too few students had been involved in the decision, with 18 of the 19 delegates on the Students' Union Council, who do represent 13,000 students, voting to support the motion. But the Countryside Alliance called it an attack on freedom of choice and said the decision should have been put to a wider student vote. Universities including Stirling, Warwick and Newcastle have also voted to go plant-based, although Edinburgh rejected the plan. The votes have been organised following Animal Rising's Plant-Based Universities campaign. This has been your Teachers Talk Radio News with Jo Fox.
We have just finished talking about Ofsted and we've talked about all of the kind of impacts that people can have with the workloads, balancing everything, expectations, and some of the different ways that we can set those boundaries, such as, you know, removing emails off the phone and things like that. Do you sometimes find a resilience to, do you find resilience is lacking in the staff workforce? Because, again, I've come from a teacher training background and I've noticed the difference in the kind of staff or trainees that we're getting where, you know, what before was never deemed as a problem, such as completing an assignment whilst working on your placement and things like that. There is a lot more, I can't do this or I need an extension, or the retention is impacted because they're dropping out. Is there something culturally beyond an extending outside of the sector that we're seeing in the newer generation of teacher trainees in terms of resilience?
I mean, that's probably a little bit out of my area of experience. The people in my generation, definitely not. I wouldn't want to comment too much on teacher trainers. As I say, I haven't worked a huge amount with them, although that is something I want to do. I do think there is a difference in some young people's approach in that they will be realistic about what they can do. They will not work themselves to burnout, and I think they will put their foot down and say, actually, this isn't acceptable, I want to do this a different way. And I think sometimes we can be of a generation that says, I'll just pull your socks up and get on with it, but we're also the generation that are drinking two bottles of wine at the end of the week because we can't cope, or, you know, crying ourselves to sleep. So I just I think there's
maybe they're doing it right.
Yeah, exactly, absolutely.
Yeah. Oh, excellent. Yeah. I suppose when you put it like that, yeah, that is a really good thing, because, you know, sometimes we're quick to judge and like, oh, well, I used to do this when I, you know, when I was a teacher, I did this. But really, has that benefited me, and has that actually, you know, or has it made me go grey before my time and probably added a good few wrinkles? But I suppose that is that cultural awareness, and I suppose that generational awareness that we need to factor in as well when we're recruiting and working with staff. And there is a different dynamic, I think, with supporting educators from different generations and different sectors, and that's something that I'm starting to develop and work on myself, and recognizing, do you know what, maybe I need to take a different approach with yourself whilst someone else might take a different angle. So that's good to note. When you mentioned about a whole school approach, could you please give a little bit more information about, you know, the whole school approach to mental health and wellbeing, and talk to us about how you come across it? And obviously, I know that you offer services around supporting that, and that's your background. So define it for me.
Oh, gosh, define it for you. How long have we got? No. So my first role out of teaching was working for Head Start Newham, who were a lottery funded organisation working across London Borough of Newham, looking at a whole school approach to mental health, well, whole organisations, we work with colleges as well, to mental health and wellbeing. And essentially the premise is that it's no good having interventions that might support an individual young person's needs when it comes to mental health and well-being. If they then walk out the door into a corridor and they're bellowed at, or they don't have the support they need, or the extracurricular things that we know support people's well-being. So the work I did was based on the resilience framework. It was based on the academic resilience approach, which developed by Angie Hart, Dr. Angie Hart in Brighton. I think she's Professor Angie Hart, actually, I should say that before she tells me off. The resilience the resilience framework outlines all the different things that can help build resilience in young people. It's loosely based on Maslow's hierarchy of needs as well, that we can't expect young people to flourish if they don't have good housing, good, you know, if they're not eating well, if they haven't got safety. And while schools can't do all of those things, they can certainly come some way to supporting them. But a big part of the work, the whole school approach, is also understanding that all the stakeholders in the whole school or college organisation need to understand what good mental health and wellbeing is and have access to support for their own as well, because we're all part of the cogs in the wheel, as it were. And so ensuring that young people have everything they need is key, but also ensuring that staff wellbeing is high on the agenda, that it is recognised that good staff wellbeing means good outcomes for young people as well, is absolutely key, because it's no good working staff to the bone and then expecting them to have empathy and compassion for the young people in front of them. I know for a fact that when I was really struggling with my mental health, I was not the best teacher I could be. I had a short fuse. I struggled to deal with some of the situations that I was dealing with because I wasn't in a good place, and I just didn't have the kind of the fuel to do that. I know now that I'm in a much better place, you know, I'm able to do that work. So the whole school approach is everything, thinking about young people, thinking about staff, thinking about the parents. How do we all work together in order to ensure that we have an understanding of what mental health and well-being is, and we can have lots of different facets that feed into that. So, you know, relationships are key to the whole school approach. Relationships with each other, understanding each other, knowing each other's challenges, and being able to work around those is absolutely key. And then lots of different things like extracurricular activities, taking responsibility, being trauma informed, all comes into place. But it is a long term process. It's not something, you know, I think some schools have thought of it, they can just do one training session or an inset day and that's it, done. And it's not that, it has to be embedded in everything they do.
So in terms of embedding it, then would you recommend policies and procedures to reflect how they're going to do so?
Absolutely.
Yeah. And
the language as well, in policies and procedures, the language, how we talk about different aspects of the work that we do. You know, I'm a big I know lots of people will probably shake their heads at this, but I don't think we should have behaviour policies. I think we should have relationship policies, because relationships are the things that are the crux of good behaviour. But when we talk about behaviour policies, all we talk about is focusing on a young person coming out of their not doing what they're expected to do. But when we talk about relationship policies, we focus on building those positive relationships. And part of that is young people following what they're expected to do, feeling confident and comfortable to have that conversation. But, you know, things like language are really important, I think.
So when you're talking about language, this is the language we use or within the policies, or the language we should be kind of articulating when enforcing those policies, or both.
Yeah, absolutely. It's got to be in the policy, and then policy and ethos have to come together, don't they? It has to be coming from the same place. And, you know, people will think it's kind of a woolly way of looking at things, but I just think language has such a impact on the way we see things.
Have there been any examples you could share where you've seen really good practice in that ethos and the language being used well? Or could you give us an example of what you might want to see if you were a good mental health aware institution?
So I think I'm trying to think of some, always the way, isn't it, when you ask for something specific and it all goes out of your head. I can't think of any school I've ever worked with. I think, you know, things like And the thing is, language is only as good as the things that underpin it. So I also want to be really clear that if you call your isolation room the reflection room, I get where you're coming from. But unless the young person is actually given time to reflect in that room, it is essentially an isolation room. So
right.
Language is only as good as the actions that you put under it as well. It's a starting point. But things like changing from behaviour to relationship policy, talking about behaviour that challenges rather than challenging behaviour, because sometimes that challenging behaviour is what the young person needs to do at that time. It's a trauma response, potentially, not all the time, but sometimes it is a response. It's something that they do. So when we see it as behaviour that we find challenging, and we interrogate why we find it challenging, and then try and look behind that behaviour and why it's happening, that can have an impact on how we work on it and think about it. And you know, I was listening to the radio this morning and someone was talking about this idea that when we talk really negatively about a young person, or we talk about them being a nightmare or being a pain, it absolutely impacts the way we work with that young person. So bringing in that kind of that positive regard for the way that we speak about young people, the way that we speak about parents, the way that we speak about our colleagues, will ultimately impact the way that we deal with them. I'm just trying to think of some examples. There are some brilliant schools in Newham. Sarah Bunnell School is an absolutely fantastic example of someone, you know, a place that really does talk the talk as well as walking the walk. And they have put co-production at the centre of everything they do. So, you know, their young people feed into their policies and procedures and feed into the changes that they make, and feed into the work that they do. And that makes a huge difference for them, and the way that they talk about the Sarah Bunnell way and what the expectations are there. It's not all about behaving good or bad. It's about having respect. It's about working in a way that engages the people around you. It's just a different approach rather than just a punitive, are you behaving well or not?
Right. So there's more to it, isn't it? It's not black and white. And I think often when we are stressed and pressured, we are less tolerant as well. And it can quite easily be, you know, this is now a behaviour that I can't deal with. So off you go. And I'm just going to write you off for now, rather than that, like, as you said earlier, investing that time to find out why that behaviour is in that way, or, you know, finding maybe root causes for these issues that, if we could unpick, could actually turn that student around for the remaining years in education and in their lives. But I think...
I just want to say that I recognise that class teachers don't always have the time to do that. So I'm not here sitting here saying every time a young person misbehaves in your class, you must sit down and get a family history and, you know, and know exactly what's going on for them. It's just not feasible. But if there were processes by which the school knew that young person and knew their needs and could communicate some of that in advance, or have opportunities for them to go to a place if they were needing to regulate, if they were dysregulated, where can they go to calm down, to get that space, rather than it being an exclusion from the classroom, it's an opportunity for them to do that with another member of staff, then that could help as well.
Sometimes having additional people to talk to in relation to a student in a positive way, rather than a let's write the student off way, is very supportive and therapeutic in itself, because sometimes you could be banging your head against a wall with a student and thinking, I don't know how to approach this learner. And then having that conversation with the teaching assistant, with the you know, additional learning support, or with your head of year or whatever, can really enable or empower some staff members to then, you know, move forward in a positive and progressive way. And I think, again, because we're so pushed, we don't have those opportunities to have those conversations either. It's more give me a list of those that are at risk and put them into extra homework club, or, you know, whatever it is, rather than can we have a chat about this particular student and what their needs and what they're portraying currently and how can. So I do appreciate what you're saying there, because I do see that day to day, and I see that in organizations where, you know, it's all about listing the students rather than breaking down, you know, the full holistic development of a learner in that program. And again, you know, it's a systemic issue, but if there was, say, a teacher who is feeling, or an educator who is feeling really under pressure and demonstrating challenging behaviours, so again, me being in a senior leader role, how would I then support that person? And how would I give them, you know, I don't have a reflection room for teachers. I can't say, go, off you go reflect. I can see some staff presenting symptoms or things like that, and I could have a talk with them, but they don't want to talk with me. And, you know, when you mentioned earlier, you know, don't offer them biscuits. I think I've done that a few times. I just said, should we have a cuppa over some biscuits?
Well, there's nothing wrong with a cup of tea. I mean, that does help, absolutely. But if that's the only thing you're offering, then that might be a bit of a problem.
And sometimes my intention's good, but I don't know what to do. So what is it? Do I say, you know, a couple of times I've had a member of staff in here, really stressed, had external factors on, and I said, do you want to go home? But I don't know if that's a good thing.
The thing is, I don't think, like, obviously that example, if something's happening externally to someone and they're really stressed, then giving them that time to go home and deal with those things is absolutely brilliant. But what I think we need is a process of group supervision in schools or groups. But I know when I was a Senko, I used to get people together. Admittedly, it was about a young person. So when they had a new pen portrait, for example, I'd bring all the teachers together and say, this is what we're doing, these are the challenges. And actually, some of the conversations in there were brilliant. Their math teacher would go, oh, well, I try this and it works really well. And the music teacher would go, oh, well, I'll try that then. And they would kind of get that commonality and find a space. But actually, I think it would be really brilliant in my ideal world, if I could wave a magic wand, if teachers had regular group supervision where they could spend time sitting and talking about the challenges that they're facing. And, you know, just like we do in clinical settings, and talking about some of the challenging young people, families, deadlines, etc. And actually having that in place so that that happens on a regular basis, so that it doesn't get to the point that they come to your office and have a meltdown in the middle of the office, that they've actually know that they've got that space and they're maybe offloading some of these things more regularly.
Does that offloading then become a bit of a moan fest?
Well, that's why you have to have someone who leads it brilliantly and it doesn't become a moan fest. So reflective spaces should be quite well held, you know, with someone sharing an experience and what there's going on for them, other people offering ideas and thoughts, and then we move on. We don't just sit there and moan. So it has to be held properly. You can't just put a load of teachers in a room and ask them to moan, because we will all moan for a long, long time. So I would absolutely do that. Holding that space appropriately, but also thinking about line management. How does line management work in the school? Is it just a tick exercise? Have you done this? Have you done that? Have you done this? Are there actually spaces in line management to say, how are you feeling? How are things going? Do we train up our middle leaders and senior leaders to have those conversations properly? Are they trained in mental health awareness to actually spot the signs when someone is struggling and know what to do to step in? I know the answer is no for most places. So but I think that should happen in all work, all areas of work.
There is a big push in recent years, maybe in the last 5 to 7 years, about middle leaders all doing coaching and mentoring, mm-hmm. but not so much mental health. Does that support in some way, or is coaching not necessarily the right fit for what we're seeing now?
I think coaching can be I am a coach, and I think coaching is actually a really good way of kind of supporting this work, because what coaching isn't counselling. And it isn't about having the answers. It's about holding a space for someone else to explore the challenges that they're facing. But how many of those middle leaders are actually using coaching and actually having the time to do that? So that, I think it's brilliant. I think that would be fantastic if all middle leaders were trained in coaching and had support to know that they are working well within that. Do they then have time to go and speak to other middle leaders about how that's working? I mean, we should put the time and money into it. But like you've already said, the pressures for all the other meetings that have to take place are huge. And it's got to be done properly, because teachers are busy people. And if they sit in a meeting and think this is rubbish, they just don't want to go back, do they? Their time is precious. So they want it to work well and know what the value is of it, and that it's going to be done effectively. I think sometimes those coaching courses, they're done once and then people are just left to it. whereas coaches, actual proper coaches, have regular supervision themselves and are able to explore how they're working in those spaces.
Excellent. We are coming up to time. So thank you so much for everything you've shared, all of your experiences and everything. Is there anything you'd like to say in terms of summarising your experience and what you've faced and seen and this entire topic of, you know, bringing awareness to mental health for educators?
I think we are losing a lot of brilliant educators who are fantastic and, you know, amazing for young people, because they are getting so burnt out because they're not getting the support they need and the expectations of them are too high. I think there is a level where central government has something to answer for, but I do think good head teachers, leaders, college principals can make a huge difference in the way that if they listen to staff and if they make changes, that can actually have an impact, as opposed to just, like I said, yoga and biscuits, then it can make a difference. I love biscuits, by the way. If anyone wants to eat biscuits, I'm not saying I don't like biscuits.
Depends on the type of biscuits, but yeah.
Obviously, let's not go. That's a whole other hour of discussion, Sabrina.
I did have one more question. Have you seen any particular phases of teachers, middle leaders, senior leaders, head teachers that seem to be more affected by mental health and well, poorer mental health and well-being?
No, I think this is the sad thing.
Across the board.
I think it's affecting everyone equally. We're all, the pressure is coming from all angles. Sorry, I can't tell you that there's anyone in there swimming around happily. I think, you know, head teachers getting pressure from the local authority and from Ofsted, they put that on the senior leaders on the middle leaders on the teachers. It's that's part of the system.
Okay, there's nowhere to run.
Children get nowhere to go. Well. No, sorry, it's bleak.
Oh no,
there are some brilliant schools out there, and there are some people that love their job and are doing a great job at it. So, you know, we do need to say that as well. It's not all bad, yeah. But we could be doing better, and we could be retaining teachers if we were doing better.
Well, I'm going to end on that slightly more cheery note. And I'd like to say a massive thank you to you, Becky. And, you know, if you want to ask Becky for further information, you can find her on LinkedIn. She's also got a site out there. And if you want to just tell us how to get in touch with you, Becky, before we close.
Sure. So LinkedIn, Facebook, Instagram, hello@beckydawsonccf.com is my email address. So feel free to drop me a line.
Brilliant. Well, thank you very much for joining me today.
You've been listening to Teachers Talk Radio. Tune in live and listen back at ttradio.org. We look forward to hearing from you next time on Teachers Talk Radio.